Hello and welcome to Talking Aussie Books, a new weekly podcast shining a spotlight on Australian fiction. My name is Claudine Tennellis. As a writer and avid reader, I love chatting about books. And in this podcast, I'll chat to authors, publishers and readers, giving you, dear listener, insight into what's hot on the Australian fiction scene. So if you're looking for your next book recommendation or just want to know more about Aussie fiction writers, this podcast is for you. Grab yourself a cuppa, sit back and enjoy. Nathan Besser is a Sydney-based author whose latest book, Wild, published by Viking and imprint of Penguin, is based on the extraordinary story of how the lives of author Daniel Defoe of Robinson Crusoe fame, notorious crime figure Jonathan Wild and petty criminal Jack Shepherd became intertwined in the turbulent criminal underbelly of London in the early 18th century. In a witty, highly entertaining but fictionalised account of the intersection of these historical personalities, Nathan has cast a contemporary spotlight on an era which arguably spawned the modern phenomena of crime writing and tabloid journalism. I'm delighted to welcome Nathan to the podcast today. Hi, Nathan.
Hello. Thanks for having me, Claudine.
It's a pleasure. Well, it's been some time since I've read a book so well steeped in period-rich language and wry humour. I thoroughly enjoyed this foray into the 18th century London underworld. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for reading it.
My pleasure. So, Nathan, I was wondering if you could tell me what inspired you to write this story.
I guess the idea commenced when I was reading The Fatal Shore by Robert Hughes. And I began reading that and I became, even though it's about the colonialisation of Australia, I became kind of stuck on the circumstances that gave rise to it, the overcrowded prisons and the London society before the first flip came out. That's when I first heard of Jonathan Wild, even though it was sort of just very briefly in a footnote. His story fascinated me the more I read of it. I'd originally planned to maybe do a screenwriting or something like that about a screenplay of it. I thought it would make a great tale that would fit that medium, but the more I sort of read of work of the time and thought about it, it sort of just became a piece of prose from there.
How did you come to the decision to reimagine the meeting of these three particular historical figures?
I began with Jonathan Wild and his story. I didn't know that the other characters would become central to the story and that they're actually sort of, you know, written in the quite closely from a narrative point of view. But the more I sort of, I guess, thought about the story, the more I came to the conclusion, it's not like I decided, it sort of just happens that these other people were very, very much part of the story and they were integral to it. So they became that way.
Now, I've been very lucky to have read this book already, but for those who haven't read it, can you tell me a little bit more about the story?
Jonathan Wild was the thief-taker general of, I think he was called the thief-taker general of Great Britain and Ireland. And he rose to that position in a time when there was no criminal justice system as we now know it. So even though almost, I think, one-fifth of London, and this is around 1700, even though about one-fifth of London subsisted off crime, that's how they survived, there was no police force as we now know it. All they had was lots of laws that would, you know, send you to the gallows or to the colonies. There was no actual way of enforcing those laws. So it was up to, that's where we get citizens' arrest from, because it was up to the citizens to enforce the laws. So there was a bit of a thriving bounty hunting industry, and Jonathan Wild became a bounty hunter through his knowledge of the underworld. He got himself into a few situations where he was imprisoned, and he knew about the opportunity that he wanted to capitalize on, and then he became, through his own wily ways, he became a government sanctioned bounty hunter. But in fact, while his job officially was to catch criminals, what he actually did was he sort of engaged the criminals directly to perform the crimes. He'd get commissions from the government for capturing those same thieves, and then he'd make money off sort of selling back stolen items to the victims. So he was sort of getting it every which way he could. He was very bold in his way of doing it, and he used loopholes in the law to do this. And that's the story of, I guess, Jonathan Wild. That's what he did, and an interesting sort of piece of trivia, which is dealt with briefly in the book, is that the term double cross comes from Jonathan Wild, apparently. So the legend goes. So he had a ledger of all the names of all the criminals that he employed directly, and he put sort of a single cross against you if you were one within his network, and then if you became meddlesome to him, or he just simply wanted to make a bit more profit out of you, he'd put a second cross against your name, which would mean he would turn you into the magistrate for imprisonment or execution or whatnot, and that was where you get the term to double cross someone.
It was actually fascinating to read in such vivid detail about the London that these men lived in. For all intents and purposes, they were products of their time. Now, I didn't know very much about these men before reading your book, and then only what I researched briefly afterwards, but you've managed to create a very rich backstory for each of them and offered some insight into their motivations for behaving the way that they do.
I can't say that it's all historically 100% accurate, or I've sort of taken a lot of license. It is a piece of fiction, but the world that they lived in was a pretty rough one. But at the same time, what was interesting to me was, you know, when I would read things that were written at that time, you know, bits of memoir or other bits of fiction or newspapers. It's sort of scary and delighting to see people also having the same concerns that we have today. So you might read an ad in the paper about for some sort of anti-aging cream that's for sale, or you read about someone going to their friend's place for dinner, and they said that they were providing they said it was a veal pastry, but in fact, for sure it wasn't. It was just straight up beef, or, you know, the sort of social concerns that people have. So I guess these were the things that interested me. I guess both extremes, ones that extremes of personal vanity and our own personal lives, but also I think the extremes of how different society was then without simple things we take for granted, like sewage or a job or.
You've just touched on it in what you've said now, but obviously you would have had to have done a lot of research to write this book. So I wanted to know how much of Jonathan's life in the narrative is real and how much fictionalized.
I don't want to spoil anything for anyone that might decide to read it as a result of your podcast, but I picked and chose different things that interested me as a writer. And then this is not a book that everything is pretty much as the historical documents would say, like, I don't know, Wolf Hall or something like that, where it's all the circumstances are real, and then the only thing that's being made up is the way people thought and felt about what was going on. So,
I mean, I guess to understand the corrupt person that Jonathan Wild actually became is to try and understand where he came from. And your narrative does go some way to incite some sympathy for his circumstances. But all in all, I found him to be extremely unlikable. A calculating and ruthless man for the most part.
Yeah, I found myself and some readers might find themselves rallying for Jonathan Wild. Like, when is he going to get through this hardship? You've got a sense of his plight, and you sympathize that he's, and I guess in a sense you almost like that he's cunning enough to create a path forward for himself in circumstances that are really challenging. That's on the one hand, but then I think if you look at how he ends up in this incredibly corrupt and violent and unlikable person, it casts a negative light on those early circumstances in his life where he's just trying to get by. But had you not understood the lengths to which he went and how extreme he became, you might actually just like the guy and think he's a clever person. But I think if we look at people in history who become monsters, the early things that they do become monstrous as well. So I guess I think he has a progression. He becomes worse and worse, and he shows his true colours more and more as the story progresses.
I guess I wanted to ask you, in the course of your research, what impressions of your character were you able to ascertain? And does that marry with the character that you've portrayed in your book?
I didn't really get a great deal of insight into who he was on an emotional level. I think he was a sensationalised character, and he's actually been sort of treated, you know, in opera and other works of fiction over the centuries. But the sort of things you can read of him, whether it be, you know, the sort of things that I was able to look at, you know, might be, you know, court documents and letters to magistrates and these sorts of more dry things. You know, we know that he was a, you know, quite a fastidious person. He kept notes. He knew what he was doing. He was clever. But his sort of motivations and the emotional content of his life, I wasn't able to. That's something of my own, certainly of my own making.
Now, many have credited Jonathan Wild's life and related historical accounts of his life as the first kind of example of organised crime. Why do you think people are drawn to stories like his? I mean, why are we interested in notorious criminals like Al Capone or Ned Kelly even? And why do we love TV programmes like Underbelly?
When it comes to taboo and things we're uncomfortable with, like sex and death and crime and blood, they will always hold our imagination going outside of what society deems to be acceptable, and certainly crime falls within that. I think the boldness with which some of these characters are able to use these skills that they have that so few of us do to rise above circumstances that a lot of us accept as the way things are for us. You know, people in general have great trouble rising above their station, whether that be the financial one or the way in which our lives are constructed around us. So when even though some people that might have been born into a family of criminals, or but often these are stories of people who, against all odds, are able to create their own future in a single-minded fashion and build for themselves great power and wealth sometimes, or certainly power. This is an interesting thing, that this is possible, and to watch people do it is even more interesting. That's my theory when you asked me. I hadn't thought too much about it, but at that time, around that the time 1700 or so in London, there was this Grub Street press and the sensationalizing of crime as a form of entertainment was certainly born then, or a big part of the formation of that trend. And the way the writers used that content was that they would write it in the first person, like Daniel Defoe did. Mm. And it became even more salacious and interesting and enthralling when you were reading it as a memoir of someone. And that's now a well-used trope in fiction.
I had no idea that Daniel Defoe was anything other than a novelist, and you've given him a story that shows him in somewhat of an unfavourable light. A weak and self-indulgent man who put his family's economic stability at risk by gambling and risky investments. But he does have some redeeming qualities in the end, doesn't he?
He was a man who was quite liberal at the time and was willing to sort of stand up for what he felt was right and liberal values. He, you know, in his writings, he was supportive of women in a way that other writers and society in general wasn't back then, and other religions as well. He came from an oppressed religion, so he understood that well, and I think as a result was a sympathetic character, and I'd like to think that some degree of sympathy can be had for him as a result of reading my work. I dealt with, you know, a bit of a change that he went through after a lot of setbacks in his life. But he was a remarkable character. He, you know, he published something like 500 or 600 books. He was a spy. He was a businessman. He had a brick factory. The list goes on and on. He invested in a diving bell to recover sunken treasure. He invested in farming civet cats, the gallbladders of which are used for perfume. He did all sorts of crazy things. Or you know, he was a bit of a statesman. He kind of was doing a million different things. The number of things he achieved was incredible. And yeah, interesting character.
Now, he's been dubbed as the original tabloid journalist since he was the first to have told stories about both Jonathan Wild and Jack Shepherd after their hangings. Did he actually spend time in prison alongside Jack?
Jack Shepherd's story was written a number of times at the time, and Daniel Defoe wrote often pseudonymously or with no name at all. So a lot of the works are attributed to him, but it's not like it might be apocryphal, but like no one really knows, but people have sort of attributed some works to him. So it's very possible that he did. And in fact, you can buy books now that say, you know, The Life of Jack Shepherd by Daniel Defoe. The short answer is I don't know if in fact he sat and had all this special time with him, but it's very possible that he did.
So how difficult was it for you, Nathan, to recreate the language of the time in your narrative? And what resources did you use to help you do this?
I quite enjoyed it. I quite enjoyed constructing the language of the time, but it's not quite of the time. It's a little bit sort of brutalized by me. I just read work of the time, and some of it was eye-wateringly boring, and I sort of moved past that and moved on to work that I related to and that was in a voice that interested me. The way that I've used language is a response, I think, to the bits that I loved and also getting fed up with the bits I hated. In terms of the resources I used, it was just, you know, reading other bits and pieces and thinking about it, poetry and fiction and non-fiction of the time. I tried to find as many movies as I can that were set then. You know, I did whatever I could to steep myself in that world.
As you've mentioned, there is something of your own idiom in there too. My favourite line was at page 206 of the book. Jonathan's just received a holding response to his letter to the Queen, which says, "Your correspondence is important to us. It has been placed in a queue and will be answered by the first available officer, yours faithfully, the Queen." that was a laugh out loud line. I mean, not only because he believes he's received a personal message from the Queen, but because I could hear that recorded message of any number of Australian government departments who tell us the same thing when we call.
Well, that's probably how they responded. So our frustrations now are, I'm sure, many are very similar to then.
Oh, it was brilliant. So, Nathan, tell me about the structure of this book and why you chose to structure it the way that you did. For example, you wrote Jonathan Wild and Jack Shepherd in the first person, but on the other hand, Daniel Defoe in the third person.
It's a good question to which I don't have a definitive answer for, except that they're very different people. And as a writer, sort of going into those characters, they were different enough to warrant a different tense. One thing I will say, though, is that I probably wouldn't have liked to have written Daniel Defoe in the first person, in that I wouldn't like to be another writer necessarily. I think going into first person is a little bit like acting. You have to really, you know, become who you're writing. So I would have felt a bit uncomfortable with that. This wouldn't have been a conscious decision at the time, or maybe these things would have sort of floated around my head, but I would have just sort of started or tried it in these different tenses, and one would have stuck, not because I calculated that was the best way for it to be treated, but more just because it felt right.
I understand your first book, Man in the Corner, which was published in 2017, has been optioned for a film by Simon Baker and Rebecca Riggs. Can you tell me a little bit more about this project and when or if we might see this adaptation on the screen?
I don't know. All I did was, I guess, sign over the rights. so I think with these things, it's a long road for anything to happen, and a lot of books get optioned and they don't get made. So I think they're in the process of doing what they need to do, you know, make screenplays, find directors and these sorts of things. So and then they need to find funding and things like that, so that none of those are straightforward things. And I don't really know is the true answer. So, you know, I might occasionally ask, and they'll say, "Oh, well, this is where we're at, but it's not really my business." Essentially, they haven't asked me to write a screenplay or have anything to do with it. In fact,
so not only have you published two books between 2017 and 2019, but you're a husband and a father of three, and you've also dedicated time to setting up a number of businesses, including co-founding the alcohol delivery company Jimmy Brings. So, for all the writers out there listening to this podcast, Nathan, tell me, how do you fit in all of these interests and responsibilities with your writing?
With great difficulty. The last number of years has been quite taxing. It's been extremely busy. And I guess to answer the question of how I find the time, it's really, I have no idea how I found the time, to be honest. Like, in retrospect, I mean, I'm a lot less busy now than I used to be. And I really don't know how I did it. I'd be up early in the morning. I'd race to work. I'd come home with the kids and I'd do some more work. And then the weekends I would often be working on the writing, and then nights sometimes at the business. It was like I was sort of mainlining cocaine for about 5 or 10 years. But so I don't really know, but all I can tell you right now is I'm exhausted and I don't advise it to anyone. But if they are compelled to write and they also are compelled or stupid enough or accidentally have three children, they're going to need to find a way to support them and do all these other things, because really writing is a tough gig from a financial point of view. So it's just tough, but you do it if you want to.
What tips do you or could you offer to any aspiring or emerging writers out there?
One tip would be to have conviction in your project and in what you want from it, sort of, not necessarily from the beginning, because projects change a lot along the way, but I think certainly in this day and age of publication, you really need to take your project all the way to the very end. You can't sort of rely on others to help make it better. I think maybe 50 years ago or something, if you were a writer and you had promise, a publisher would sort of sit with you and develop you, and these kind of, the industry doesn't operate like that anymore. You need to really arrive to them with a very finished product. You need to have conviction and really, really believing in your story, for better or worse, because your instincts on a particular issue might not be great, but you need to stick with it. Otherwise, you end up sort of flailing and not quite being sure. You can't rely on others, essentially. It's a very lonely road, and you have to be willing to stick it out on your own, both, I think, from a discipline and work point of view. You need to be able to just sit at the desk and come back to the desk day in, day out, but also from a construction and narrative point of view, you need to be willing to stick it out on your own.
It's very instructive to hear about what other people think is important to their writing journey and to success. So that's great. Thank you. So, Nathan, I wanted to ask you, what's next for you?
I don't know. And even if I did, I wouldn't say. I've got some work that I've sort of tinkering with, and what that develops into, I don't know. The last couple of months, I'm trying to take a break from doing so many things. So I'd like to have a few months, really just, being with my family and just living a more regular life for a while. But I don't know how long that'll last for. But I've still got something I'm sort of tinkering with. So
Nathan, if listeners wanted to connect with you, where could they find you?
My wife set up an Instagram page, I guess that way. I think it's Nathan Besser, author.
Nathan, thank you so much for joining me on Talking Aussie Books today. Been fascinating to chat with you about Jonathan Wild and his exploits throughout 18th century London. I wish you every success with your book.
Thank you so much for having me, and it's been great talking.
Now, as always, listeners, to be in with a chance to win your very own copy of Nathan's book, Wild, head over to my Instagram or Facebook feeds and follow the prompts. Well, that's a wrap, folks. If you enjoyed this podcast, please leave a review on iTunes or drop me a line via my Instagram at Claudine Tennellis or on my webpage claudinetennellis.com. Thanks for listening. Until next time, happy reading.